This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Dr. Bill Stone is an explorer, inventor, and outer space dreamer. He has spent years of his life on exploratory and scientific expeditions and has logged more time working from remote subterranean camps in the world's deepest caves than any other human being, including spending 2 years at depths of more than 1,000 meters beneath the surface. So his lifelong quest has been to go deeper beneath the earth than any human has ever ventured. And his goal was to set a new world record by finding a passage beyond a depth of 7,208 feet, proving once and for all that his theory that Cheve Cave in Mexico is the deepest cave in the world. So he joins me now all the way from the US to share more about this expedition, which has been compared to climbing Everest, but in reverse. And he's also going to tell us more about the new documentary film which chronicles this expedition, Explorer, The Deepest Cave, which has premiered on the National Geographic Channel. Welcome, Bill. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
Very good. It is a warm, sunny day here in Texas.
Okay. Well, you know, Bill, I think I was reading up about you and I think someone wrote about you that, and I'm quoting here, Bill Stone has managed to cram several lifetimes worth of exploration into one and he's not done yet. And I understand that it was space, actually. That was what you wanted to explore, but you were deemed too independent to become an astronaut?
Well, that was the opinion of the NASA psychologist back in 1989. Luckily for me, actually, the way things worked out, I'm pretty happy that, you know, I didn't go down that route because it opened up a lot of other avenues that that I have no regrets about following down. I'm still working space issues. We still build robotic systems here for NASA, and we do have still plans for manned exploration on the moon. So all of that stuff is going on in parallel to what we do underground.
Mm-hmm. And yes, and I do want to talk about that a little bit later, but let's talk about Sistema Cheve, right? So this is, as you've described, a cave with the potential to be the deepest on Earth. Now, I understand you joined an expedition to Cheve in 1988, and you've had a very long history with this place. You're far from done with it. Tell me about, you know, how you first heard about it in 1988.
Actually, it was a phone call. In January of that year by an archaeologist who had gone down there, and they had been contacted because the people who had originally found it less than a year earlier had come across some amazing artifacts in the entrance. And so they called this person down, and she saw the stuff and saw the cave. And when she came back, she said, you need to get down here. There is something big going on. And so about 3 months later, there was a recon trip to go back. And it included most of, at that time, the best cave explorers in the United States. Since then, it's become a truly international project. Mm-hmm. We typically have 12 or 14 countries involved. But that bit of advice was right on target. Cheve is extraordinary from any standpoint. It starts big and it stays big. And it is now so remote that it is, in fact, the most remote place anybody can reach inside this planet. And, you know, the exploration front is still out there. So it is a true modern, you know, no gloves exploration challenge that's sitting down there.
Mm-hmm. And why is it believed to be the deepest cave in the world? I understand that in 1990, I was reading, explorers dumped some green dye into the stream flowing into Cheve's mouth. I mean, what did they discover from there?
So the dye was fluorescein, and it produces a brilliant chartreuse green color. And I remember specifically the day that it actually happened. There was a group that had gone all the way down to the bottom of the mountain. It was a long, long ways away, and over 2,700 meters vertically below. And they had been prepared to do scientific tests of the water. They had activated charcoal traps down there and things like that. And when they walked into base camp, this guy had this funny grin on his face. And I said, yeah, I said, did you guys get some traps you're going to test? He says, we don't need any traps. I'm going, yeah. He says, the water in the river was this color, and he pulled out this chartreuse colored toothbrush. And so it was so strong a trace that it actually turned the entire river green.
Wow.
And that happened in less than 8 days, which meant that the water was not going through any restrictions or any lengths where it would be slowed down. So we knew in 1990 that, you know, this was at that time and still is, you know, the world's deepest dye trace, which means if you can prove that humans can get through it, you have, you know, the official record for the world's deepest cave. And so it is still more than half a kilometer deeper than anything that is known.
Okay. And, you know, just for context, right, what currently holds, I mean, who's the current record holder for the deepest cave in the world?
Yeah, sadly, it is in Abkhazia. And it had been mainly explored by Ukrainians. The original one was Krubera, but that has recently been passed by Verovkina, both of which are now pretty much at the limit of what they can do. They're right at 2,200 meters. Cheve can go 2,700 if we're successful in getting through.
Okay. All right. So again, as you said, if a human could navigate the full length the water did back in 1990, then Cheve would be declared the deepest cave in the world, correct?
That's right. Yeah. And I'll add a note here for people who are interested in statistics and logistics. Right now, to go to a place like Krubera, you can do that in a 2-week trip. The cave is relatively straight down, so you're on ropes the entire way down. There's very little horizontal extent. As of this spring, Cueva Cheve is 83 kilometers long, involves 12,000 meters of rope rigged in it, 7 underground camps a day apart just to reach the end. And the average push to the end of the cave now is between 25 and 30 days long.
Wow.
It takes a 4-month expedition to make any progress at all there. So the standards of size and remoteness and difficulty are on a completely different scale.
Okay. All right. That's really quite mind-blowing. And of course, you know, over the last, 30 years, you've established a chain of underground camps leading deeper into the cave. And of course, you know, the new one-hour National Geographic special, Explorer, the Deepest Cave, which premiered on the 30th of May. So that's based on the 2021 expedition. Am I correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And you had like what, 70, more than 70, 74 of the world's elite deep cave explorers from, what was it, 8 countries participating with you? 9 countries.
Nine countries that year. Usually it's more, but for some reason, I guess it was the COVID issues were still in effect back then.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And okay, so it's mad, right? I mean, the sort of planning that an expedition like this takes months. I think I was reading, you said before, you know, for every bite taken underground, a whole chain of people have paid for that in sweat. Talk to me about, you know, the logistics, the planning that goes into an expedition like this.
I'll give you, just to give you an idea, right now we are having our first planning meeting for a 4-month push in 2024. That's coming up. That's coming up this week. So it takes not quite 2 years to plan for a project of this nature. There is probably going to be a reconnaissance a mission of probably on the order of 4 to 6 weeks next spring, just to set up for the main push in 2024. We're starting to line up teams. We're looking at strategies for how to support them. Let me give you one idea of how this thing has unfolded. When we were there in 2021, we started in early January, and by April, the final crew of support people were coming in. And at that time, we had a phone system. It's an earth conducting phone system that goes through the entire cave all the way down to Camp 6. And the people at Camp 6 were running out of food and running out of equipment, and they were desperately playing for the people who had arrived in April to get that equipment and food down to them. Well, the telling detail is that it never got there in that entire month. That's how the whole logistics pyramid unfolds. If anybody gets sick, if anybody sprains an ankle, if anybody you know, just feels tired because they've been working for 12 to 14 hours a day hauling 20 kilogram packs on rope. You know, all of these things affect morale, the ability of a human crew to deliver that stuff. And so basically what happened is the pyramid at the bottom was wide and the top of it was just a couple of people out there trying to push further. And the supply chain never got there. And so the expedition had to retreat. And so that is the dilemma that we're looking at right now for 2024, is that how do you even support a crew that is out there in such a remote place? You know, you have to eat. What we are doing is looking at ways to break the chain with regards to power, electrical power, specifically what we use in our headlights, in our survey tablets, in our survey instruments, our dive lights, you know, our main drills that we use for rigging, anything that uses electrical power. We're looking at ways to actually generate that in the most remote places within the cave. But that's only part of it. You know, the rigging equipment weighs something. The food weighs something. We have tried for decades to increase the energy density, the caloric density of food. What we eat would not look like food to you.
I've seen, yes.
You know, when you're burning, you know, 7,000 calories a day, which is not uncommon, and we do that for months on end. You know, this is nothing like the Tour de France. Tour de France is intense, but it is very short. This is sustained. I typically will lose 15 kilograms on an expedition.
Wow.
And we try to prevent that, because once you go past a certain point, you're not burning fat or carbohydrates, you're burning protein, which means your muscles.
Yep.
And so you can hurt yourself if you go too far without eating enough. And those are the big problems that we're facing.
Mm-hmm. It's you said it's one of the most mundane, but you know, it's so critical, isn't it? I mean, as you said, you've lost people, you know, on these sorts of expeditions. That is, of course, the worst thing, the worst case scenario. So it's every step has to be planned. Every step has to be so careful and thought out, isn't it?
When we, and I do this several times, because not everybody can stay for, you know, for 4 months. So we have support teams that will come in for like 4, 5, 6, sometimes 8 weeks. And the lecture that I give them in base camp basically says, look, here are the three highest priorities that we have here. The first one is nobody gets hurt. The second one is we want you all to have a memorable time that makes you feel like this was worthwhile in your life, because you're making a great sacrifice to leave your jobs for that long. And the third one is we come home with the most data that we possibly can, because exploration without data is nothing. It is the quintessential measure of whether you brought any new knowledge back. And so we survey, we document, we photograph, we film, you know, we study. As we go, but those are the big ones. And what everybody is made to realize very viscerally is that this is not like an astronaut job on a space station where your life is controlled second by second by somebody at mission control. You have complete control second to second to kill yourself. And if you do, then you are going to quite likely nuke the expedition. You know, only in very rare circumstances are, you know, you able to carry on after a fatality. And so the problem then is that every single individual is out there doing their own thing. And we have to instill in them the idea that you are responsible for your safety and you are responsible for the safety of your teammates. So you have to have a completely different mindset than most people think about. You have to be on it every second that you're down there. And if you're not, you have to be empowered to say, you know what, I'm dropping my load and we're going to camp right here until I feel better or until I get some sleep. And so we have had many times people bivouac between underground camps, hours away from these things. And sometimes they'll carry an emergency communication system and they'll call in and say, hey, this is what happened.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what happens is we don't hear from them. Then, you know, within 24 hours, there's a rescue call out and the expedition is designed to be capable of self-rescue. There are no other rescue teams in the world that will come in here and swoop in and save anybody who's out there. We have to do it ourselves.
And the sort of psychological, you know, toll that that takes as well. I mean, yes, you have to be physically fit, you know, you have to be alert, but, you know, you are also in these unexplored, tight, you know, twisting passages. It's just like, you know, uncharted territory, basically, right? How do you even start, you know, that sort of training, you know, for that complete darkness and as you said, the weight of remoteness?
Well, there's a couple of things you said there. I just want to dispel one thing. The movie, unfortunately, gives the impression that most of the cave was very tight and constricted. That is completely false.
Sure.
It's probably 99.99% of the cave is absolutely stunningly enormous. And part of the problem that we had was trying to film that because it was so big. Where it was easy to film, you know, in small constricted spaces, and that was where the drama was. So that's what you saw in the movie. But most of this cave is 50 meters in diameter. I mean, it is, you could fly a plane through it. But getting back to your first question, the idea of remoteness and psychology, a long time ago, a good friend of mine, Bill Steele, coined this phrase, rapture of the deep. And it's a psychological situation where if you haven't done this before, when you get down very deep, you start to have this problem where your mind is dwelling on how many drops you come down and how difficult that's going to be to ascend those. Because unlike mountaineering, when we're done and we're tired, now we have to climb Mount Everest to get out. And yeah. that is a very serious thing weighing on your mind, you know, because, okay, how weak do I allow myself to become before I have to leave because I won't be able to get out? And people who are new to expedition caving, especially serious long duration expedition caving underground, the first couple of days that they're down there, they will just get this blank million, you know, kilometer stare. and their mind is not there. Their mind is, how am I going to get out? And as you get more experience, you basically begin to say, you know, when I wake up in the morning, this is where my job is. I don't really care about what is above me. So when you're at Camp 6, you know, and you've already been in the cave for 17 or 18 days, you're not thinking, oh my gosh, that is a long way out. You know, how am I going to feel about that? No, what you have to think is, how much food do we have for today? Do I have the right equipment that I need? And where are we going to go that has the best probability of advancing the exploration front? That is what you need to focus on. And so by the time you get to Camp 6, the only people who are out there are those who have had that experience. They are over that and they are able to focus, you know, with intense clarity on what the job is that have to be done and nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I mean, you've had to make some tough calls, you know, at these, you know, these very critical points, right? I guess, you know, you're also just focused on exactly what needs to be done, isn't it? There's nothing sort of clouding your judgment, as I suppose, at that point in time.
Well, it depends on, you know, where you're talking about. I mean, like we have, I don't know, half a dozen or eight people who are long time expeditionary experience people that are associated with the project who can trade off with the job of being in control of, you know, the base camp. And base camp, you know, we have a thing called, you know, mission control. And that's where all the communications lines come in. And those people who are still up there, sometimes it's me, sometimes it's somebody else, because, you know, I'm still fit enough to be wanting to be down there, you know, and so I get my turn too. And so we swap out, but those people who are up there, they know what the game is. They've been there, they've seen it all. And so they know every twist and turn of that cave. They know every rope, they know every camp. And so when they get the call, you know, from Camp 5 saying, gosh, you know, we are short on 9mm rope. What are we going to do? You know, that person up on base camp is the one who's sitting there looking through the charts going, okay, according to the last inventory I've got, Camp 3 has got 80 meters of rope. There are five people there right now. I can task two of them to get that to you tomorrow, you know? Mm-hmm. And so then you're sitting there, it's like a switchboard operator, right? You know, and you're playing this little game, you know, of chess, you know, where you're moving these pieces around and you're hoping that, you know, you're going to, in the end, get that stuff to where it needs to be so that, you know, the whole team as an integral unit can succeed. And this is one of the things I think that really brings people to this project is this is a team effort of extraordinary dimensions. Everybody is dependent on everybody else. Mm-hmm. 10. And so they're all working, you know, and then eventually a few of the most experienced ones are gradually going to be working their way down until the time that the crew that is out there at the front, you know, their time is up. They've burned out. They need some daylight, you know, and so they're on their way out for their 30-day trip. But the people who are sitting at 15 days at Camp 5.5, it's their turn, you know, to shine. And so they'll swap out, trade information, you know, and wish them good luck. And then, you know, these other guys, man, they've got five more days to get out of the cave and see daylight. And those other guys, they're going down for another, you know, 2 weeks beyond where they were. So the durations are just becoming, I think, incredible. We kind of predicted this about 10, 15 years ago. We said, what happens if this happens? And everybody's going, I don't know. Because how are we going to support somebody on a 30-day trip? Well, guess what? We're at that point right now, and Camp 7, you know, is just going to be the demarcation point for Camp 8, wherever the heck that is, you know, and the pyramid is just going to get wider and the distances are going to get tougher. So it, to me, that's, I don't know, that's kind of the part of the neat challenge of this place. You know, if we just walk through and establish the world death record tomorrow, which we could do if it was open tunnel, you know, the whole way down, you can move amazingly fast if you have open tunnel. But, you know, it's the challenge of doing this, I think, is what keeps us all coming back.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, maybe for those who haven't caught the documentary yet, right, maybe you can help explain the sort of dangers and risks involved in these sorts of expeditions, right? I mean, you could even drown from flash floods, am I correct? And there's hypothermia, there's falling rocks, you know, so many things, am I correct?
Those are, yes, all of them, but they are risks that we've learned to fairly well control. So let's just take them by point. You talk about flood. Mm-hmm. Chevy is at very high altitude. It's at almost, well, it's a little over 3,000 meters at the tops of the peaks there. And so it turns out that the rain up there is not so persistent as it is elsewhere in the tropics. For example, Wawa, which is a kilometer and a quarter lower in elevation, they get a lot more rain there, and being trapped in a cave over there is much more likely. We've had two water trapping incidents. In fact, I was involved with one of them in 2009, where we were in a parallel cave to Chevy called J2, and a flash storm, just a freak storm during the dry season. We normally go in the dry season when you don't have much water, but a freak storm from the Gulf of Mexico came in, and it flooded a 25 meter section of tunnel that normally was air filled. And so there were seven of us trapped at Camp 2 for a week.
Wow.
Until we had to go down a day and a half. We went down further into cave to retrieve diving equipment that had been staged for the next year, brought that back up. And then six of us dived out and got emergency gear for the seventh person. And in the time that we were doing that, the water level dropped just enough to get about 5 centimeters of air above that otherwise water-filled tunnel. And they were able to get her out by just putting her lips against the roof and pulling her along.
Oh my goodness.
You know, it was a close call, but you know, the thing was, we were set up to survive because we have these underground camps down there and they're stocked, right? We have food, we have sleeping gear and things like that. So if you do get trapped, you just retreat to the nearest underground camp, which is at higher level water than places that might flood. So that's one thing. Rockfall is rare. And the reason for that is the most likely place to have it is in these vertical shafts. And the people who go down first will carry the rope in a bag below them so that it's not hanging out below them. And they will then clean the wall of all loose rocks as they go down. So if that's done correctly, the likelihood of rockfall is extremely low.
Okay.
And, hypothermia, you bet. We've never had anybody die from hypothermia, but we have had people be, operating at less performance than, you know, than they could be because they spent too much time in a cold water section. And the way we try to deal with that is one of two things. One, we rig the ropes out of the water wherever we can so that we, you know, there's only a couple places in Chevy right now where you are really in the water and there's no avoiding it just because that's the way the passage goes, and you have a gigantic waterfall coming down and you have to go through it. And I think maybe in the movie there's a short scene showing a place like that. But generally the rope rigging will keep you out of it. It's technical, so you're on the wall, on the rope, you know, for long distances. The other alternative is that we build these three-dimensional maps of what's inside the mountain. We have LIDAR surveys at the top of the mountain, And so we try to think, you know, from the geological standpoint, how can we find another tunnel that doesn't go where the water is going? And this year we actually succeeded early on. There's actually a scene where the drone is flying through this tunnel and you see these people marching along with bags. That was a new discovery this year, and it connected two parts of the known cave that bypassed hours of wet, windy cave and shortened the trip between Camp 2 and Camp 3. So things like this still happen, even 30 years after that part of the cave had been discovered.
Okay. And as you mentioned, you know, like your past inventions, they've really helped with mapping out all these unexplored underground areas, right? And you've produced traditional 2D and CGI 3D models of Chevet Cave so that others can study the cave and also discover what the future holds?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, that, you know, if anybody's really interested, that data is public. You know, we don't hide anything. The place where we have done much more sophisticated maps, though, is in underwater caves using fully AI-controlled robots. And so if anybody is interested in that, there's a YouTube video that you can see called Sunfish Namibia that has a very interesting little 14-minute short movie on where we are with that. So, you know, it's robots are coming. is the message.
Okay. And, you know, just going back to the documentary, there's so much there, you know, and it was really quite heart pounding. I couldn't breathe at some points as well. But, you know, how did it feel, you know, when you stepped into those newly discovered areas, places that people had never been before, which was, I think, a huge part of this particular expedition?
Oh yeah, more so for some than others. For a lot of people, you know, you just worked and worked, and maybe you got a little bit. And for a couple of people, there was just some amazing, spectacular moments. And you know, I've been there sometimes. Sometimes I miss it, you know, but I know what the feeling is, and it's really hard to describe, because if you haven't actually been there in the moment, you can't feel it. But what is happening is there's this little process going on in your mind where you're taking this step and your mind is going, oh my gosh, no one has ever been here before. And so it's this little feedback loop, you know, where you're going, we're doing something here that is extraordinary. It's not just, you know, walking down the sidewalk. This is discovering, you know, America, whatever, you know, for the first time or whatever of like that. And it's an ephemeral thing, because once the first person has done it, even the next team that comes behind them is using their information and their markers to, you know, to show where the route goes. And so it's like, oh, okay, yeah, here, we just go down this way now, you know. But that first that first time is, you know, it's religious. It's special.
Okay. All right. And we've spoken about how it's both psychologically and physically, something you need a lot of training in that. And I guess what's next? So we see in the documentary that you reached a certain point and then you had to go back. But of course, there's plans in place for, you know, furthering this exploration, isn't it?
Yeah. In fact, we have already been back. I just got back about 3 weeks ago, We had a 6-week reconnaissance trip. Yeah, it almost felt like it was a little too early to be back this year because of how much time we had spent there the previous year. But it was a recon trip, and to cut to the chase, we were working on a cave that was located almost halfway from the Chevet entrance to where the water comes out of the mountain. And it's a very, 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 very tight, constricted cave, but we're down 370 meters deep right now, and it is pointing in the direction of Camp 7 in Cueva Cheve. And if we were to somehow be able to get through there, it would, in theory, provide a back door so that we would not have to do this incredible distance from the entrance. So it's kind of like, okay, we're looking for options for how to explore the entire cave. And, you know, the old school British approach would be, let's go, you know, by the hardest route and see if we can get somewhere, you know. And so what we've decided to do is investigate these possibilities for back doors that are not as hard. It would only take us maybe a day or two to get into the limit of exploration via those entrances if they were shown to connect, then go back. So right now the idea is we're going to do one more reconnaissance trip to this possible backdoor cave in 2023, and 2024 is going to be the, you know, the siege, if you will, going back and taking on where we left off in 2021. So as you can see, you know, it takes a lot of time to try to work these problems. You can't just, you know, say next week I'm going to go do it.
Yeah.
It's the effort that takes to get everything prepared on site. It'll take us 3 weeks minimum to even reach Camp 3 if we go back to Cheve in 2024. You know, that's just to get started. You know, and then to enable people to work out there, you need the other 3 months. And then there's a week or two of breakdown and getting everything packed up, and you know, everybody goes back to their job. So it's, you know, there's not too many places or endeavors I can think of today where 4 months, you know, is required for you to commit to that kind of thing. And it's hard to get people away from their jobs. They have to plan for years in advance. But the thing is, we've never had any employer deny participation of a team member because they realize that this is Olympic class stuff that's going on. These are quiet, unknown sportsmen of Olympic caliber that are doing some of the most amazing things in the world, and they are special. And you know, their employers do understand that and give them the time off when it's time to go.
Yeah, and it's so much left unexplored, right? And I think, am I right in saying that's what keeps you going?
Oh yeah. I mean, the craziest thing about Cheve is it's like one of these, you know, puzzles where you're putting pieces together and going, where's it going to go? How's this going to come together in the end? Well, all those 35 years that I've been working there, we have just by looking at the mountain and the three-dimensional map that we built, we have seen less than 30% of what may be existing there. Less than 30%. Mm-hmm. My guess is by the time this is all done, there will be somewhere between 250 and 300 kilometers of caves under that mountain.
That's crazy.
We're just seeing the first bits of it right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, you know, it's a wonderful, the documentary is a wonderful sort of, I guess, you know, just a sneak peek into, you know, the kind of craziness that goes into all of this. You know, for anyone's listening who might be interested in, you know, not quite a caver, but might be interested in taking it out, what would your advice be to them?
You know, certainly you can go to commercial caves and see what it looks like underground. That's certainly a safe, easy starting point. However, there are many caving organizations throughout the world. Mm-hmm. In the United States, they have a national society that has branches in a lot of the larger cities. And so you can get your start there. I actually started in high school in 10th grade because one of the teachers found out that there was this organization in town, and they had them come out and give a lecture. And everybody, well, wow, this is kind of interesting. We should try this. And so these people at this local society chapter taught us how to do the techniques and invited us to go on trips. They were very forthcoming, and most of these organizations are. So, you know, there's international organizations. There's the International Congress of Speleology based out of France. And every 4 years, there's a major international convention. In fact, it's happening in Chamonix this summer in last week of July, coming up in just about 2 months.
Okay.
So there's lots of places to find information. If anybody is interested in our project, you can go to usdct.org, and there are downloadable books you can read, all kinds of information on past expeditions.
Yeah, that's the United States Deep Caving Team, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Yes. I was looking through, you know, right up from 1980, right up to 2021, all the different expeditions, all of that is listed there. So yeah, people can get a real feel for it and read everything that you guys have been through actually. Yeah.
Yeah. There's quite a bit of information there.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Bill, for joining me today. Any last message you'd like to leave us with to any explorers out there, perhaps?
Just that the original exploration in real places on Earth is not done yet.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Bill.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Bill Stone, caver, explorer, and inventor. You can catch Explorer, The Deepest Cave on National Geographic Channel or Astro Channel 551 on Sunday, the 5th of June at 3:15 p.m. Or you can catch it on Monday, the 6th of June at 4:10 p.m. And if you'd like to find out more about that documentary, just head to nationalgeographic.org. If you miss any part of our conversation today, you can always download the podcast at bfm.my/learn, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.